The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I think one of the things I was most aware of all the time is, are we causing more chaos? Or are we actually affecting the situation in a positive way? Are we dismantling the violence and the chaos, or are we just creating more by conducting some of the operations? From our perspective, because Iraq theater is a military primacy theater, so the CIA had primacy when they went into Afghanistan for operations because they were first in. This was not declared a war in the way, same way that Iraq was then. Within Iraq, DOD had primacy, so we were more in the support role than we were in Afghanistan. And continuously aware of how military would be using some of the information, wanted to make sure that we always had some type of analysis, top-line analysis, even if it's just raw intelligence we're sending back to them. We wanted to be clear, here's the context.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 4th, 2019. In movies and TV shows like Zero Dark Thirty and Homeland, Hollywood has fictionalized the roles of intelligence officers in tracking down terrorists. But the truth is often filled with personal and political challenges beyond those that screenwriters imagine. Neda Bakos worked in several jobs at the CIA, including as a targeting officer focusing on the founder of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. In her new book, The Targeter, she describes the experiences and challenges she faced along the way. Last week, David got on the phone with Neda to talk about what a CIA targeting officer does, what it was like interrogating detainees in Iraq, and the difficulties she encountered in getting her book to print. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 423, Neda Bakos on The Targeter.
Neda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You betcha. You've got a remarkable book that's out. The Targeter is the title, and that's a title that may not resonate with everybody until they read it to find out this description of a job that few people really understand within the CIA. And we're going to get to it, your subtitle being My Life in the CIA, Hunting Terrorists and Challenging the White House. We're going to break down each part of that, but I want to start a little bit earlier. How did you get to the point where you were even working at CIA? What road took you there?
I was really focused on working overseas. And at the time that I finished undergraduate, it just didn't seem plausible that a U.S. employer would pay me to work overseas. We were in a bit of a recession. Grad school just kind of seemed out of my grasp at the time because I was trying to figure out how to pay for it. So I just toiled around for a few years and finally applied.
Now, something happened before you even got there, which in a sense was a preview of some of the dangerous situations you got into in Iraq that we'll talk about later. You were a college freshman and you were just hanging out with your friends one Monday night. What happened?
Oh, well, we were actually, I was part of a sorority and we were crossing a street and a drunk driver came at us. And I don't remember the accident, but this is the recall that has been told to me and hit four of us walking across the street. So, yeah, that was a bit of a life-changing situation. That was the first semester at Montana State University in Bozeman, and so I had to drop out for the remaining time period, and it shifted, certainly shifted things for me and my perspective.
Mm-hmm. some of the book, you talk about your experiences getting into CIA, and your path into CIA was not the traditional one for someone who ends up targeting terrorists and working in Iraq with some of the hardened criminals that came in that you had to interrogate. You came in and you were actually doing an HR job, of some kind of a corporate consulting type job. Talk a little bit about that job to dispel people of the notion that CIA is all just operators and analysts. What were you actually doing when you first came in?
Well, I never had set out to be an HR professional. It was just never something that I had thought about. And I just happened to fall into that line of work because it was available when I was out of school, and started working just as an organizational consultant and in org development. And so when I came in, I was working with the operations side and trying to figure out how they modernize their workforce and what should those jobs look like and how should they align for their mission.
That doesn't seem like a clear path to what you ended up doing, analytic work. How did you get there?
As soon as I joined, I really wanted to do a different job. You know, HR is great work, but it just had never been my passion. So when I realized you could move around within the agency, if you're qualified for another position and apply, I was really focused on that. And I had a fantastic boss who really supported my goals. So he was very much championing anything that I really wanted to pursue at that point.
Eventually, you got to the point where you were doing analytic work, and you give a rare window in the book to something that isn't described much, which is the training that an analyst gets. You describe a program, I think you abbreviate it as CAP, the Career Analyst Program. Talk a little bit about how it is that people from diverse backgrounds, including yours, got up to speed in the analytic tradecraft in order to do the job that a CIA analyst does.
So, David, I don't know which CAP class you were, but
I was before it. I was unable to partake in the joy that you had.
So I think we were the 10th class that went through the training. And we were older, so we weren't the custom pithy young analysts right out of grad school. Mm-hmm. We were cynical and probably put our teachers through the ringer a bit more than they needed to be.
I will say that CAP Class 10 has a bit of a reputation. It has a ring to it because of some of the things you pulled on your own instructors. What were some of the things that you did that manifested themselves that way?
Yeah, well, some of it, you know, were just typical pranks on some of our fellow students, but they also incorporated unwittingly the teachers that were part of this process. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I go through some of that in my book, some of the anecdotes of the camaraderie, some of the things we probably shouldn't have done as adults. But at the same time, I would say that we did learn, you know, some valuable analytic tradecraft at the same time, in spite of ourselves. We learned how to be all source analysts, how to write all of these products. You know, I couldn't have gone on and done the other jobs had I not really actually paid attention at some point.
And what does that actually mean when you said you learned how to do the analytic work? What describe the job of an analyst and how it's different than some people assume?
So an analyst, and you can correct me or add to this, an analyst is somebody who digests information, intelligence, and raw information and collection, and paints a picture for the policymaker that actually truly analyzes that information and interprets it for the policymaker so that they have a clear view on a set of problems that they're actually trying to deal with.
But your job is not to recommend policy, is it?
Correct. So even within all of these products or in any of the briefings, we do not recommend policy. We are not allowed to do that.
It doesn't mean you don't have opinions about policy. And in fact, later on in the book, you get to descriptions of U.S. policy towards Iraq and the occupation and afterwards. You clearly have opinions about those. But as an analyst, how do you keep that opinion from getting into the work product you're creating?
Well, and that's really one of the crux of the analytic tradecraft, is making sure that you remove bias. So you're always, you're either made aware by your peers or the writing process itself when you're doing the analysis. And part of the process helps eliminate the bias.
Mm-hmm. Let's get to the chronology of your book. Really, the bulk of your work, it's about Iraq during the period when a senior manager that I knew well and you would know as well described the post-invasion scenario in Iraq as going from bad to badder to worse. And you talk through all of that with specific focuses on your jobs and how you did them. Early on, you write, in hopes of making yourself invaluable around the office, you said yes to everything, including volunteering just a matter of weeks after the U.S.-led invasion in early 2003 to go to an assignment in Iraq. What were you doing in Iraq when you first got there, and how did that evolve?
When I first got there, there wasn't really a set role for anybody. I knew what my marching orders were from my team chief at headquarters. There had been another team member ahead of me, so he gave me the 2-hour lay of the land as soon as he got back and I headed out. So as soon as I landed, really my whole focus was still trying to confirm the analytic picture that we had prior to the invasion. And if there were changes, I needed to report those through official channels. And then in addition to that, continuing to look for signs that Zarqawi was still building an organization inside of Iraq.
And that's your first mention of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and that takes up a whole portion of the book. Your early work in Iraq seemed to focus a lot on looking, what you describe as looking backwards, trying to describe the relationship or lack thereof between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda before the invasion, instead of some of the analytic problems you clearly found most compelling, which were what's happening now and where is someone like Zarqawi going. Talk a little bit about the tension you felt out there working on those issues that were being requested by policymakers in Washington instead of building up some of that analytic work to help prevent catastrophes in the future.
Right. I think you summed it up perfectly. While I was out there, we were still having to confirm this historic analytic bottom line versus looking for current threats, what's coming up on the horizon, trying to evaluate, the time and space that we were in currently. That was incredibly frustrating because things were starting to go downhill very quickly inside of Iraq. The insurgency started to rise. There was the UN bombing. There was a major Shia mosque bombing. So there were several things that were starting to happen inside of Iraq that we felt like were more of a pressing need than continuing to answer some of these questions about evidence that the administration had been using to invade Iraq. That's cart before the horse. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed to be a distraction that was not needed.
Mm-hmm. Among the real characters in this book that you talk about is a member of the former Saddam Hussein regime that you had the chance to interact with in the interrogations. You nicknamed him Evil Hagrid. Talk a little bit about him and why he mattered.
He mattered because he had been in the leadership circle of the Iraqi intelligence service under Saddam. So he had a lot of knowledge about not only historical connections, but he had a lot of knowledge about were there any operations in place for them to act on either overseas or inside of Iraq once the U.S. invaded.
Why'd you call him Evil Hagrid?
Well, I use that term because he was a very large man and not a nice guy. He was known to have done a lot of what we would consider crimes in this country.
And with him, you didn't just sit down and ask him questions as you'd been doing with some other detainees. What different interrogation tactic did you and others use to try to shock the system without violating your own ethics in doing so?
So in this instance, we came up with a different scenario where he would be, without explanation, moved to a different location. And we would set up just a conversation within this location, just trying to elicit more information out of him. So it was like a interpreter and the interrogator or the questioner, and then Evil Hagrid. And in this case, it was inside of an old bombed out shelter, just meant to use that location to try to at least confuse him, take him off guard, because at this point, he'd been not exactly forthcoming about a lot of information we already knew he would have some insight on.
And how did it work?
Well, Once we got inside the shelter, a couple of things sort of went awry, and we ended up having to interrupt the whole interview with a series of, like, what I would consider now humorous antics evolving, just trying to make sure that we were still secure with him, trying to keep him in a shelter without military policemen nearby.
Did he know that he did not have military police surrounding him, that he was basically free to go at one point?
I'm thinking he had no idea, or he probably could have just left.
You also talk about your interactions with one of the leading figures in modern Iraqi history, someone who rose to the level of deputy prime minister under Saddam. And here's how you describe it in the book. The first time I spoke with Tariq Aziz, I saw him in his underwear. I think he actually preferred it that way. Talk through that, because that's not the thing you expect to read when you hear about a very ordered discussion or interrogation with someone like Tariq Aziz. How did that happen?
Well, he was actually in the hospital at that point. He'd had some heat exhaustion, and he just decided to be the belligerent old man and try to turn the tables and take me off guard. So he opened up his bathrobe or his lovely hospital gown and sat down in his underwear on the bed across from me. And it was hot in there, so he was using it, you know, to cool himself and, like, flapping it back and forth. And when I didn't react, he just kept continuing on with the conversation and eventually closed it. But it was a surreal experience, because he's one of the most recognized figures that had been working under Saddam, those iconic glasses. Mm-hmm. He's the spokesperson that we would always see talking about foreign affairs. So, seeing him in person for the first time in that vulnerable position, but yet still trying to take control of it, it was interesting.
There were times in reading your book that I wish that there had been some accompanying pictures. This was not one of those times. All right, let's move to the foundation for the bulk of your work. And what you're talking about here, really, for the first time, is a detailed study of what it's like to do the job of targeting regarding a major figure. We don't mean targeting strictly in the kinetic sense, the military sense. We're talking about targeting in a fact-building pattern of life understanding sense. The origin for this, really, as it relates to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, was what happened with the Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA, in Iraq, issuing decrees that former Ba'ath officials could not have roles in Iraq's future government, and that the security services would be completely disbanded. And the combination of those meant that you had overnight 500,000 Iraqis without jobs, many of them turning into violent criminals, the kind of people they used to try to keep in Iraqi jails. That led to the situation in Iraq that suddenly you're back into again, analyzing as a targeter how someone like Zarqawi takes advantage of that situation. Let's use this as a chance to talk about this new position that didn't really exist as such. You say it didn't even have a name yet. What is a targeter, and what does someone like you do when you are spending 8, 10, 12 hours a day targeting someone like Zarqawi?
When I became a targeting officer, then I moved to the operations side out of the analyst position. Mm-hmm. And so by then, I am really focused on pulling in all the tactical information. Instead of synthesizing it for the policymaker, we are trying to paint this analytic picture on how we can leverage some of this information to conduct operations, dismantling his network, dismantling his leadership, trying to track down his leadership. So most of our day was spent trying to piece together different operations that we can then engage with military or some of our own case officers on the ground.
So is it fair to say that your customer focus really changed? You're not doing the traditional job of an analyst writing for policymakers here in Washington to grapple with national security threats and devise ways out of them. You're really focused on writing for military officers and for agency operations officers to help prosecute this war effort. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Well, I think you summed it up perfectly.
And then in doing that job, you have different challenges, because one of the challenges of a traditional analytic job is politicization, which is knowing what the customer wants to hear. Do you consciously or subconsciously change your analytic line to either give the customer what she wants to hear or to actually just, you know, keep putting an answer out there just to make them angry? Either way, letting it affect your analytic line. But you're talking something different here now. There's a different danger involved in targeting, because the military officers or the agency operators sometimes want an answer of their own. They want you to give them certain information to allow them to complete their mission. What do you think were the greatest risks inherent in this relatively new profession you were doing as a targeting officer?
Well, I think one of the things I was most aware of all the time is, are we causing more chaos or are we actually affecting the situation in a positive way? Are we dismantling the violence and the chaos, or are we just creating more by conducting some of the operations? And that, you know, from our perspective, because Iraq Theater is a military primacy theater. So the CIA had primacy when they went into Afghanistan for operations because they were first in. This was not a, you know, this was not declared a war in the way, same way that Iraq was. So then within Iraq, DOD had primacy. So we were more in the support role than we were in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And continuously aware of how military would be using some of the information, wanted to make sure that we always had some type of analysis, top line analysis, even if it's just raw intelligence we're sending back to them. We wanted to be clear. Here's the context. Because if it's taken just out of context or raw intelligence is just used without any type of analysis, it can really go awry.
Did you have any cases of that where you felt you were providing information that was misused?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
How does it feel with, in this case, obviously with policy, analysis matters. But in the case of targeting, your analysis could be a life or death decision within minutes being taken by those to whom you're providing information. How did it feel as a targeter having that information, in your opinion, misused?
Infuriating. You know, there was times when we had missed opportunities. There's times when things were taken out of context. There was times when, you know, some of these rolling raids that ended up happening, it was just like this giant bulldozer or snowball effect that just, you know, just because we could, we did, and wasn't useful. And it can be really, this is going to sound almost trite, but this is, it can be really disempowering. When you're trying to do your most accurate type of analysis that you're providing to whatever the action arm is, and it's misused, you become really cautious then about what you want to share.
Mm-hmm. And if you do that, that has an effect also. If you become overly cautious,
absolutely,
you're not giving them information they need in other areas.
Right. And that's always the struggle, right? There's always bureaucratic blockades to this also, because how we share information within the government is still, it was still a challenge at that time. But, you know, we were as forthcoming as we could be. We had one person embedded with the military, with special forces, almost the entire time, so that we could share information and we could provide on the spot analytic capability. So we were doing what we could.
Yeah. Now, during this time frame in late 2003, going into 2004, Iraq is going downhill. The violence is increasing. You took a career change. That is, you moved from one of these line positions and became a branch chief, a manager. Talk through the difference between being a manager and working for a manager at that level.
Yeah, I had made that change probably fairly soon after I moved to the ops side as a targeting officer. So I was a manager probably within a month, I guess, of moving to the ops side or before that. But I don't know. It hadn't been my first management job in my life. But it's still, at the same time, there's a lot of moving pieces when you're dealing with a war zone. And I'm sure that would had to be frustrating, because I wasn't paying enough attention at times to like what I could be providing as far as leadership and managerial focus for a lot of the people that had worked for me. So you're trying to, on a daily basis, still do your job in an efficient way, but at the same time, fulfill the needs of a war theater. And that can be pretty difficult.
mean, you were still mired in the substance at that point. You probably knew Zarqawi as well as anybody at the agency. You'd been watching him in various contexts for years. Now you're a manager helping others do that as well. There was a key turning point in, I believe it was October 2004, when Zarqawi finally pledged allegiance to Osama bin Laden. Why did this matter?
Well, and at that point, I was still an analyst in the DA,
okay,
director of analytics. So that matters because this is the crux of what the administration was trying to piece together as evidence before the war for why we should invade Iraq, because they were talking about how close Zarqawi was to Al-Qaeda. Well, he hadn't been. He didn't even, when he started out, have the same shared ideology. He's an extremist, but that was kind of the extent of it. So at that point, it mattered because all of a sudden, the profile and the resources and the legitimacy that lended to Zarqawi, that dramatically changes his role in Iraq. That makes him a much bigger deal.
Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of Iraqis signing up and going along with him, committing these attacks. But there were also some Iraqis who were fed up with this. And you describe one dramatic day in February of 2005 when Special Operations Forces got a tip from an Iraqi citizen who decided to help fight back against this reign of terror. I wonder if you can talk through that story of how you learned about this tip and how it got you very close to Zarqawi.
Well, you know, there were multiple instances, I would say. This is one of them that I was able to write about. But there were multiple instances of Iraqis not wanting to live like this. This living in chaos, having to constantly deal with destruction, nobody wants to really live like that.
Sure.
And there were Iraqis, just not unlike ISIS, when they were trying to control territory, being forced to work with these organizations because they had no choice. This is who's governing their space. This is a person that, you know, you have to go through them in order to, you know, buy and sell products on a market. So I think in large part, there was a lot of people who were, you know, interested in trying to quell the violence.
And many of them don't have a way to do that. They want to quell the violence, but they feel powerless. This local you write about actually knew some of Zarqawi's pattern of life, knowing that during a certain late night window, Zarqawi could be found in his white truck driving north of Baghdad, which is exactly what, as a targeter, you want to be able to provide to the troops on the ground.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely true. So that's a big deal, being able to get that type of insight.
So what did they do with it? When they got that insight, how did they take action?
You know, working with special forces, they were able to use some of our ISR platforms where we were tracking his vehicle, and ended up ISR being overhead on a drone, just camera angle.
Mm-hmm.
We were able to track his vehicle, and we weren't positive it was him in the vehicle at the time, but what we could tell from the pattern and everything that we had been told prior to this, we were pretty sure it was likely him and a driver. And so once they had location, special forces were then basically in a vehicle pursuit for some time. And eventually he drove into a farm, got into a bunch of, you know, a tree canopy where we couldn't really have visibility at the time, and took off running. And we weren't able to track to give them coordinates on where exactly they were going. But they did get a hold of the pickup.
How did that feel, being that close to actually seeing him on the video feed and knowing that he escaped?
Yeah, that's frustrating.
Mm-hmm. You got the next best thing, though. You got his computer. What did that give you?
We did get his computer. There were some issues around getting into the computer.
What do you mean?
That I go into in my book. Well, again, there's a lot of interagency issues that sometimes disrupt and get in the way of completing a mission, and that was an example of one.
Is this one of those examples of tension between the military and the CIA in terms of who has primacy?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So what happened in this case? How did the computer information ultimately come out?
Well, it ultimately came out because an agency that was able to get into it finally received the computer and was able to retrieve all the information off of it. But by then, a lot of it had eroded because too much time had gone by. So a lot of the phone numbers and a lot of the technical information we could actually collect off of it were no longer useful.
You raise a good point here, which is probably an element of stress for you as a targeter, for your team when you're managing a team of targeters, is the perishability of the information, that it's so time sensitive. You capture this computer, if you don't get that information active again within hours, the people can move on to different code words, to different phones, to different patterns of communication.
Yes, 100%. So the timeliness of when you first gather raw intelligence, especially if it's captured either from a raid or off, you know, a computer, anything like that, the turnaround time needs to be really, really short in order to utilize any of that.
Yeah. Let's fast forward a bit to June of 2006, when Zarqawi actually does meet his end. Tell us about what you were doing at the time and how the news came to you.
I transitioned to a different role within the CIA. I was with some colleagues and I actually saw it on the news. I had just came down from my hotel room. I was in the lobby and it was on the news. At that moment, I was really wishing I was with my colleagues to be able to, you know, congratulate them, thank them for finishing this, at least this portion of what we set out to do. So it was disappointing I wasn't at least there
right.
for that.
Right. What about the aftermath? You note in the book that your story really wasn't done then, because your name and some of your work showed up in some official reports. Talk through that a bit.
Yeah. I got a phone call from CIA security office one morning and they said, hey, we would like to send out a security team to do a security review for you because your name is in, not redacted, is in a report, the torture report.
This is the report that the Senate put out?
Yes, it was the report that Senator Feinstein's staff had released. And I wasn't aware of it. That was not on my radar. My mom had just passed away within days of this phone call. So I wasn't reading the news or anything else at that point. And it was a bit shocking and surprising to have this kind of coming back around to, you know, by then I had left the agency altogether. So, yeah, sometimes it feels like none of this goes away for anybody. You know, my piece of the torture report was, I was a footnote. I wasn't a central, it was based on a person that I talk about in my book that we actually had picked up in Iraq that was connected to Central Al-Qaeda. Hassan Ghul. So, you know, while it supported, I think, their bottom line that torture doesn't work because of something I had said, at the same time, I would appreciate a phone call to let me know my name was going to be in it.
Right. All right. So let's reflect back on this and talk about some lessons. First of all, lessons, if you were to, in a sense, train targeters and train others in the U.S. government how to work with targeters, what are the main lessons from your experience about how this process can work well?
Some of the main lessons that I actually learned were that personalities matter. The bureaucratic hurdles are not insurmountable. There's always at least ways to start to communicate, to deliver analysis. And I think that more than anything, this is really about ultimately what's the strategy that has to be agreed upon for all agencies to be able to work together. I think ultimately, had I had this to do all over again, there's a lot of other conversations I would have had with leadership and special forces that would have been much more transparent. I think I was new to doing all this at that time and didn't know how to drive some of the discussions I think that would have really benefited our team.
What about lessons for people going into this line of work, people considering a profession as, in particular, a targeting officer? What do you wish you would have known at the start, other than that, in terms of how to approach the job and how to succeed at it without falling victim to the stress it creates?
That's a really good question, and not one I've been able to totally answer for myself. But I think the advice I would give to anybody that's going to go into that line of work or even that type of profession is, while there's a sense of urgency, especially when you're working with a war zone, there's not, as long as you're acting with integrity and you're doing what you can to manage the situation that's within your control, that's enough. There's no superhuman quality that will magically appear that will help fix everything.
Let me ask you about a different lesson, and this goes meta, because this book was largely ready to be published several years ago, but you had perhaps the most challenging experience with the agency's pre-publication review, and in fact, the U.S. government's pre-publication review that I have heard of in recent years. Could you talk for just a little bit about the process of putting in a book like this for classification review and what happened in your case?
Well, my case, it had been held up for a very long time. So the book that I wrote actually had a lot of other agencies mentioned. So there is a reciprocal agreement between the CIA and Department of Defense and other agencies to allow them to review any book that they have coming through publication review
right.
that mentions their agency. Mm-hmm. So mine had been farmed out to all these other agencies. Well, within that reciprocal agreement, there is no way for the CIA to enforce a deadline and require them to respond or say, if you don't respond by this date, we'll consider this acceptable. There's nothing in that agreement. So mine just lingered. It sat at DOD without, I guess I did get a response, I should say. I got a response. And my response was lots and lots and lots and lots of black pages with zero explanation.
And the black pages, that this was basically them saying this material is not allowed and we won't let you publish it, but they did not explain why.
Exactly. They didn't explain why. I had sent it with 1,500 footnotes. So I was documenting the information I was finding in open source.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this was very confusing to me as to why an entire page would be black.
Right.
And I had requested meetings. I was told no, I couldn't meet with DOD. CIA couldn't sit down with me. So the only recourse I had at this point to extract it out of the government was to actually file a lawsuit.
And talk about that process. What does the lawsuit entail? And then how did it work in your case?
Highly recommend finding an attorney who is very familiar with national security law and this process. And in my case, I found Mark Zade. He helped interpret for me what some of the process next steps needed to be, and then worked with the DOJ attorney once we filed the suit to work through the process. And so got a meeting set up, sat down with CIA's PRB, and then DOD in the same couple days.
I'm presuming that this prompted action in a way that simply making requests did not.
100%. Mm-hmm. So this time we went through every single redaction that they had. Some they gave up. Some we talked through. Some I agreed to either provide other sourcing or agree to just take it out altogether.
Okay. So the question that a lot of former agency officers get after publishing a book that's been through this process, how much of what your original idea for the book was, how much of that came through in the end after that long process, including the lawsuit?
There was quite a bit changed. There's quite a bit taken out. There's quite a bit changed. I don't know exactly. I would guess at least 30% was removed,
mm-hmm.
and another 20-30% was changed.
Did you ever get the sense that some of the removals were not due to classification reasons, but they were requesting things be removed because they just simply shed a poor light on one or the other government agencies involved?
In some cases, I think that's true. In other cases, and then I pushed back on a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
But in other cases, there's a lot of really unclear guidelines. So we don't have an overall process, right? CIA has their guidelines for what they find acceptable. DOD has their guidelines, which I just still don't totally understand. FBI has their own. NSA has their own. So everybody just has a different interpretation of how the review process should work. So I had to figure out per agency what was acceptable.
Nada, thank you for talking with us about your life in the CIA and hunting Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Final thoughts in terms of policy. You talked earlier about the fact that analysts don't do policy. Analysts inform policy with good assessments, but they don't do the policy. However, you can't work in this business for a long time without having a policy view that comes out of it in terms of what works or what doesn't work on the ground. What are your recommendations for policy now as private citizen to policymakers grappling with, for example, whether to initiate a conflict with Iran if prodded into it, or how to manage the sticky situation that still is Iraq. What stands out to you the most?
Well, that we haven't had lessons learned. We seem to keep repeating the same old mistakes over and over. Iran is the perfect example. This drumbeat leading up to this and the anonymous sourcing, you know, in various publications about how Iran is threatening the United States. We have yet, as the public, been able to see any evidence other than some of this amorphous information that the administration is putting out. I think that there is a time and place for declassifying anything that requires the American people to give up kids, money, resources toward a foreign policy problem that an administration thinks that we need to focus on if it's not extremely clear.
Well, thank you, Nada. We appreciate it. And good luck with your book.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please, if you haven't yet, give the podcast a 5-star rating and a review wherever you listen to podcasts, and share us with your friends and followers on Facebook and Twitter. You can buy Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. Our podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.